next case is 06-1638, Disciplinary Counsel versus Jerry D. Robertson. Mr. Caruso.
Good morning. My name is Jim Caruso. I represent the respondent in this case, Jerry Robertson. At the start of the hearing before the panel, the chair read a statement that included the following. As a panel under the rules, we are empowered to make findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommendations. The burden of proof is on the relator to establish misconduct, and to do that, it must be proved by clear and convincing evidence. In other words, it's the function of the panel to serve as the judge, and it's the function of the relator to serve as the prosecutor. In this case, the panel assumed the role of the prosecutor and denied the respondent his due process rights. Even though the panel and the board agreed with disciplinary counsel that there was not clear and convincing evidence to prove a violation of DR 1102A4, it nonetheless found that respondent's conduct with regard to the Greiger, Lane, and Michelson strongly supports the conclusion that respondent was dishonest and deceitful. The panel and board therefore considered this aspect of respondent's conduct as an aggravating factor. The evidence cited by the panel and accepted by the board in support of their position that respondent's conduct was dishonest and deceitful consisted of Mr. Robertson's testimony in response to questions put to him by the panel. The panel found that Mr. Robertson gave false statements and that he was not entirely forthcoming with regard to the issue of the Michelson fee. The panel believed that respondent was alternating between claiming that the fee was for past and future services and or for processing the annuity claim. Mr. Robertson had stipulated that the fee was for past and future work. However, during his testimony, he related the conversation that he'd had with Mrs. Michelson, in which she suggested that he take one-third of the fee, and he said no, he would take 25%. That had always been Mr. Robertson's testimony. That was his testimony in the deposition given to disciplinary counsel during the discovery phase of this matter.
And counsel, he didn't ever make a statement that that was also for future work?
He said both, Your Honor. He said both. He related that he was charging a fee for past and future work.
And the past work was about $300?
Yes.
And so what was the amount he took, $9,000?
It was 25% of whatever the annuity was,
which
around $9,000.
About $9,000.
Yes.
So he was going to do $8,000-plus work in the future for this woman?
That's correct.
Well, how can you figure, you know, a 25% of the amount that was recovered and then anticipate that I'm going to do $8,000 more work for you when there was nothing left to do?
Justice O'Connor, I'm not suggesting that this was a reasonable fee in any respect. Mr. Robertson has stipulated that this was not a reasonable fee. The question comes into play as to whether or not his testimony was forthright and honest with the panel. And what they're trying to say is because he made a stipulation in which this conversation, which he had previously testified to, was not included in the stipulation, somehow he was being disingenuous in response to the panel question.
Well, I guess I really don't understand how he can have it both ways, that I'm going to take 25% and pursuant to a conversation with the elderly client, and I'm also going to justify that because there's this understanding that this is for future services, when no future services were necessary or reasonably anticipated. It sounds to me, as it probably sounded to the counsel, that that was kind of a treading water here to make up some kind of justification for the 25%.
And I would agree with you, I don't think that's how the panel interpreted it. The way I read their opinion, they were saying because the stipulation said one thing, but in your testimony you raised this other issue, this conversation, you were not telling us the truth. But in fact, the conversation had been related in his deposition testimony. It was not included in the stipulation, as I pointed out to the panel, because it takes both sides, relator and respondents, to agree what goes into the stipulation. That part of it was not agreed to. I don't think their concern is the concern you're expressing, the way I read their opinion.
Mr. Caruso, there's an interesting issue here that I'd like to explore with you, and that is your contention that because the panel and the board did conclude that there was not a violation here of DR 102A4, not clear and convincing evidence of that. So that's the record before us.
Yes.
That's the dishonesty allegation. And yet, as you know, the panel and the board recommended that there's a, but his, what they saw is his deceitful conduct, both at the hearing, I think, and also with the client, warranted a higher penalty, recommended higher penalty sanction than might otherwise have been recommended. The relator cites a couple of cases in which we have done that, Aldridge and Watterson.
Yes.
What's your response to that argument?
Those cases involved evidence of the respondent being uncooperative in the disciplinary process. In this case, the relator has stipulated that Mr. Robertson was cooperative during the entire process. Those cases are clearly distinguishable. Those people did not cooperate in the, they ignored the complaint against them, they failed to participate in the process, or they outright lied or did other things during the process itself with the disciplinary council, which resulted in those findings. But here we have this panel saying, because of the testimony given to us and the way we interpret it, we're going to make a finding of dishonesty and deceit in this case. They just came around to the back door where they clearly admitted there was no clear and convincing evidence to find a violation. The fact that the panel was concerned that the disciplinary council had not cited Mr. Robertson for violation of DR 1102A4 in the Greiger case. The disciplinary council was questioned by the panel, why didn't you do this? I think it was pretty clear at the hearing that they were somehow believed that the disciplinary council was not doing its job in prosecuting this case. And instead, they decided that they would take over the prosecution. The issue raised one of the other findings that they rely upon in saying there was deceit is they claim that their calculation of the interest paid did not amount to 5% as called for under these notes. That was never a question posed to the respondent during the hearing. We never had an opportunity to address that issue at all. They also said that Mr. Robertson only through happenstance revealed that he had left the state. Again, it was never an issue. That question was never asked of him. It was never anything that was brought up during any part of the process of this case. And finally, they're arguing that, well, he didn't admit his wrongdoing. Specifically, he denied that he was deceitful or dishonest. He readily admitted all provable charges against him. He came in and stipulated to this case. And as a side, I would just say that
I'm wondering how much credit, how much good feeling, how much lower penalty should one get because one cooperates in owning up to an awful lot of bad behavior. It might just be the realistic thing to do and also save you some attorney fees if you just own up to it when disciplinary counsel knows about it. And therefore, not worthy of very much weight in terms of considering a reduced penalty.
There are practical aspects to admitting, as you've just pointed out, Justice Pfeiffer. However, I think it's also important that we know that the respondent in these cases recognizes that what they have done is wrong. Without that recognition, how are we going to have rehabilitation?
Well, now, what kind of a revelation is that, given what he was doing?
I've read cases where the respondent does not admit. Okay, there are hearings that go on for days, and ultimately the court upholds a finding that there was a violation even though the person didn't admit it.
Yeah, but that's because either the lawyer in trouble or the lawyer's lawyer is being a jerk. That happens too.
Yes, I can't disagree.
Okay.
But I do think, and I guess this is the other issue. We're always advised at the beginning of these hearings by the panel, we hope that the parties will stipulate as much as possible. We all recognize that these are all volunteers doing a very difficult and time-consuming job. And so we do stipulate. And then we go in and are told, well, we're just not going to accept your stipulations. We're going to have a whole hearing on this thing. What message does that send to respondents and their counsel when we're trying to conduct these hearings? Where do we draw the line here?
Well, sometimes the panel might also be trying to send a message to disciplinary counsel.
And I understand, but is that their function? I mean, I guess
that's... Well, it would be, wouldn't it?
Pardon me?
It would be, wouldn't it?
If they feel that there's something, then they have a specific question about it, they have to raise it. But to wholesale say, let's go ahead and have a full-blown hearing on something you've already stipulated to, I don't see the purpose. I'm just saying, I think this could be handled in a different way.
Mr. Caruso, are you suggesting that the panel's hands should be tied when there's a stipulation of this type? I mean, frankly, looking at the underlying facts that were stipulated to, and then a two-year sanction recommended.
Yes.
I mean, couldn't the panel have felt there was a real disconnect between the facts that were stipulated to and what may be perceived as a light sanction? What should the panel do in a situation like that?
I think they could have addressed that with me and with disciplinary counsel. Why is it that you're recommending a two-year sanction in this case based upon these facts? We never got an opportunity to say that or to give our reasons for that. I mean, frankly, you know, here we have a man who's 25 years of an unblemished record, a man who served his country in the military with good conduct, a man who served the citizens of Oak Harbor and Ottawa County as a prosecutor, a man who had 12 or so character letters submitted on his behalf. Clearly, he admit what he did was wrong.
Well,
but
counsel,
based on that record, I'm sorry?
Yeah, you say an unblemished record. I'm having trouble with that, given
Well, unblemished up to the point of
what
these.
What I read here, but yeah, but doesn't it make one wonder what else might have been going on that's never been detected? I mean,
well, again, I think that rises to speculation that, again, we're talking due process. How do you?
Most illegal activity doesn't start out on a grand scale, does it? It starts out smaller.
Honestly, I'm not sure that's true, but okay. I understand your concern. But I think based on the record, based on the mitigating factors in this case, that a two-year sanction was very much appropriate.
Counsel. In the scheme of what lawyers can do to misbehave and violate their oath and responsibilities, this is right up there. Taking money from clients, especially the type of clients that he was dealing with, there's very few things, if any, that are more reprehensible in the professional world of lawyering. Would you agree with that?
Stealing, if it's stealing, is absolutely nothing more reprehensible. I would remind the court that in this case, we had the evidence of the notes, and we had the evidence from the other gentleman who said that although he couldn't recall if he was asked, he certainly would have allowed him to borrow money. And I think that is a distinction in this case. It's not clearly theft. But
well, some thieves don't use a gun.
Okay.
All right. But here we have an individual who admittedly is going to go practice or is not going to practice in Colorado or Ohio or any other state. And a two-year suspension certainly would be reportable in any jurisdiction that if he changes his mind.
Yes.
And so.
And he still has to reapply.
So
it's not like he can just walk right back in.
I understand. So to him, what's the difference between a two-year suspension and an indefinite?
To him, what is significant here is that he's been accused of being deceitful and dishonest, when he does not believe that he was, and we don't believe that from a due process standpoint, he was given the opportunity to defend against, and that finding is what troubles him more than anything. And obviously, an indefinite suspension is a higher penalty, and is, we believe, is not warranted under the facts of this case. We would ask the court to not accept the recommendation, but to adopt the recommendation of the disciplinary counsel and respondent for a two-year suspension.
Thank you, Mr. Caruso.
Thank you.
Ms. Brown.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Lori Brown on behalf of Relator Disciplinary Counsel. I would first of all like to address Mr. Caruso's due process argument. Mr. Robertson was initially charged with a violation of 1102A4 in count two, which is the Lane matter. Disciplinary counsel moved to dismiss that count by stipulation at the hearing. Be very clear that the panel and the board did not find that Mr. Robertson violated 1102A4 en route to finding that he was deceitful and dishonest. Relator submits that Mr. Robertson was on notice, if you will, of the aggravating factors set forth in Section 10 of the rules and regulations that follow GovBar Rule 5. The factors that are in play in this case, Section B, that the respondent displayed a dishonest or selfish motive, Section C, a pattern of misconduct, Section D, that the respondent committed multiple offenses, Section F, submission of false statements or other deceptive practices during the disciplinary process, Section G, refusal to acknowledge the wrongful nature of the conduct, and Section H, vulnerability of and resulting harm to victims. Now, that being said, Your Honors, I agree with Mr. Caruso to the extent that the panel and the board's findings as to some of those aggravating factors are not quite accurate. I don't know that there's a better case out there in a situation where a respondent has accepted responsibility for his actions. Mr. Caruso is correct that some of the explanations were not great. I mean, there is no doubt about that in response to the panel's questions. But were they deceptive? Were they lies? Was he not admitting what he did was wrong? I don't believe so, Your Honors.
Yeah, I guess that's the issue. It seems to me we have to, with which we're confronted for other cases, because here we have the panel concluding that his conduct did not rise to the level that they could recommend a violation of 102A4, and yet they recommend, a higher sanction, or at least the sanction they recommend is based in part on their finding that he was deceitful. I have a little problem with that, frankly. Have we done that before in the past where we've let the panel or the follow recommendation where they say, we don't find enough evidence here to reach clear and convincing, but we still think he was deceitful and dishonest, and so we're going to find that. Help me out on that. This is an important issue to me. I think we have to set a standard here so that our panels and the board understand how we're going to apply this circumstance.
Probably the most recent example of that, and both issues are apparent in that case, is the Farmer case, which was decided last summer, Columbus Bar Association versus Derek Farmer. And that's a case in which Mr. Farmer was initially being investigated by the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, and he provided false information to our office, and then the case was ultimately prosecuted by the Columbus Bar Association. The board, based on the fact that those false statements came out during the hearing, the board then, sua sponte, if you will, found a violation of 1102A4. This court said that due process concerns prevented it from finding that violation, but his deceptive and dishonest conduct with regard to the disciplinary counsel would be considered an aggravation. This case is completely different than that situation because Mr. Robertson was the only person who testified. Mrs. Greiger is deceased. Mrs. Mickelson is deceased. Mr. Lane was at the hearing. I believe he answered one question, perhaps two, and said in essence that he had nothing to say. The only witness that was presented to the panel, and was called by the panel, not by relator, not by respondent, was Mr. Robertson. It is certainly one of those cases where inherent in some of the violations, for example, the conflict of interest violations, that he did not advise his clients that they had the right to separate counsel or should have separate counsel in making a decision as to whether to loan their lawyer money. Could that be considered deceitful and dishonest? Perhaps, and maybe that's inherent in the rule. But that is certainly not written in the rule, and that may in fact be a due process violation to find one violation within another. That's not how this case was charged. That is not how Mr. Robertson defended the case. That's not how the rules are written, as this court well knows.
So you're suggesting to us, Ms. Brown, that you were surprised by the outcome reached by the panel?
I would say no. In the grand scheme of cases that are decided by this court, As you well know, misappropriation of client funds is grounds for disbarment. 10 days before the hearing in this case, Relator filed a pretrial brief recommending an indefinite suspension. At that time, Your Honor, was before Mr. Robertson had in fact accepted responsibility for his conduct. The questions from the panel earlier about why 2 years, why shouldn't this be an indefinite suspension? Generally, cases involving indefinite suspensions, and not across the board, but are reserved by this court for individuals who must prove that they are fit to be readmitted to the practice of law by clear and convincing evidence. In Relator's opinion, as this case progressed in the, say, 2 weeks before the hearing, and even going back farther than this, this case went on for more than a year, Mr. Robertson did not seem to us to be the type of individual that he would need to prove his fitness for readmission. He had repaid his clients once he realized what he did violated the rules. The promissory notes are in the record. They were signed by Margaret Grieger. She was aware. Of course, she was not alive to testify as to anything, so what we had was the promissory notes. You know, he accepted responsibility for his actions. I can't be more clear about that.
Well, we don't often see that stipulation signed by yourself or Mr. Coughlin with respect to recommendation of a sanction, which is what is troubling me in this case.
That you don't often see stipulations with a joint recommendation of a sanction?
Precisely. And
I don't know a percentage, Your Honor. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Okay. I guess what I want to know is if there is a due process concern that you are joining with respect to what the panel has done in connection with its findings.
We are not joining a due process concern at all, Your Honor. We believe that Mr. Caruso and Mr. Robertson were on notice, if you will, of the fact that the panel could reach conclusions regarding the respondent's dishonesty, if you would, on the basis of the aggravating factors, which require only reasonable evidence.
I think I didn't understand your argument. So,
I'm sorry.
So you are not troubled by this argument with respect to due process?
We are not.
Okay.
We believe that, as this court knows but has not yet articulated, there is obviously a standard for proving disciplinary rule violations of clear and convincing. There is not an announced standard for proving aggravation and mitigation factors that are listed in Section 10 following the rules and regulations. We submit that the Varble case from Arizona, in which the Supreme Court of Arizona held that reasonable evidence was a sufficient standard for proving aggravation factors, such as deceptiveness with the hearing panel, failure to cooperate during the disciplinary process, that reasonable evidence, which in the panel's opinion and the board's opinion, and obviously Relator will defer to the panel and the board with regard to their opinions, that is their function.
So basically your position is that you can have inherent in the commission of the acts and the underlying charges, acts of dishonesty and deceitfulness, that can be aggravating factors but maybe not rise to a separate ethical violation.
Yes, Your Honor. The burden of clear and convincing evidence in the disciplinary process is taken very seriously by the panels, by the board, and by this court. No one knows that better, perhaps, than Relator's counsel. When we arrived at the hearing, we did not believe we had clear and convincing evidence of a violation of 1102A4 with regard to Mr. Lane. That's the reason we dismissed it. We believe that today, as the panel did, that there was not clear and convincing evidence.
What rule would you have us, if you had time to think about it, what standard would you have us write in with respect to the situation where the panel does not find clear and convincing evidence to recommend a finding on a rule, but yet wants us to consider the conduct, same conduct, as a mitigating factor? There has to be a standard here, doesn't there?
There is not a standard articulated, Your Honor, yet. I mean,
I'm asking you if you can give us one off the top of your head.
We believe,
if not, that's all right.
We believe that the Arizona court is accurate in its suggestion that it's holding, in its footnote number 7 in the Varble case, that reasonable evidence is what's required in a finding by the court of an aggravating factor. And I believe, obviously, in the Varble case, the facts are somewhat different because there was more than the respondent testified. So his version was quite different of the events, was quite different than his client's version. He was charged with being dishonest, and the Arizona court said he wasn't being dishonest within the violation of the rules. He was merely defending himself, trying to present his case. Every respondent is allowed to do that, as this court well knows.
I guess that's what bothers me about this case, is that it seems to me either if you believe him, then no violation. If you don't believe him, then it's clear and convincing. I guess that's my problem with this sort of, well, we're not really sure, and so we're going to say aggravating circumstance. That's my concern about a rule like this, I guess.
Which is why I think brings us back to the beginning of Mr. Caruso's argument. Were his explanations dishonest and deceitful, as the board found? They were the best explanations he had. The panel did not like the explanations. Perhaps they didn't believe parts of his explanations. They're the only explanations that are in the record. He mentioned a couple other factors or a couple other findings by the panel. For example, they found that Mrs. Grieger was not given copies of the promissory notes. There's nothing in the record about who had copies of the promissory notes. This is a case where I'm not sure that with regard to the aggravating factor of deceit and dishonesty, you know, there's even reasonable evidence. With some of the other factors, certainly the vulnerability of the victims, there is reasonable evidence that those victims were vulnerable. They were elderly, not represented by separate counsel. A pattern of misconduct, another aggravating factor, reasonable evidence that there was a pattern of conduct. Resulting harm to the victims, brief because he paid them back, but yes, there was some harm. But with regard to deceit and dishonesty, that I'm not sure if there was reasonable evidence. With that, Your Honor, we would respectfully request that this court give serious consideration to both the relator and respondent's recommendation of a 2-year suspension, as well as the board's recommendation of an indefinite suspension. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Mr. Caruso, you saved enough time to give you a minute. A little under a minute.
I would just like to address your question regarding what standard should we apply. As Justice Pfeiffer pointed out in the argument before this one, this is a death penalty case with respect to lawyers anytime you have these situations. And I would urge the court to adopt a clear and convincing standard, whether it's to prove a violation of the code or the new rules that are going into effect February 1st, or any aggravating circumstance. Because if we're going to say you couldn't prove it by clear and convincing evidence of violation of the rule, but nonetheless, if it appears reasonable, we're going to come around the other side and say we're going to use this as an aggravating factor and we're going to increase your penalty or we're going to disbar you permanently, I think that requires a clear and convincing standard as you apply in the violation of the rule standard. And I would urge the court, if you're going to do that, that's the standard to apply.
Thank you, Mr. Caruso.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.